everybody, to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. With me to talk U.S. men's national team and a whole bunch of MLS is Lyle's dad. It's Sam Stachel. Hi, Sam. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. I've never been introduced that way before on a podcast, or maybe ever. So
you don't introduce yourself to people as Lyle's dad?
No? Yeah, hello, Lyle's dad, Sam. pleasure to meet you. No, it's going well. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm excited. We're going to have some fun.
We sure are. We have, as I said, those two topics to be discussed. We also have some questions from Twitter. And I wrote that introduction before we got this question off Twitter, but I'll start here. It's from a person with a prominent mustache. I forget his name, but a creepy mustache on Twitter who also writes about MLS. Said, Sam, when you're walking your dog and he stops to greet another person's dog, what is your go-to way to end the interaction? Is it have a good one? Is it come on, bud? Is it just silence and staring at the ground?
It's a combination of have a good one and come on, bud. It's like usually like, okay, buddy, let's go. And then like, have a good day. Like after that. And usually my dog is doing something stupid. So like we get to like laugh, like share, like kind of like a weird forced chuckle on the way out.
Weird forced chuckle. That's the best.
But I like to spice it up sometimes. Like the other day, I'm a Chicago Bears fan. The other day he was like very excited. Because my dog gets more excited to greet humans than other dogs.
Yeah.
So he was very excited to greet this other person wearing a Bears shirt. And he got a little too excited and he like tried to jump up a little bit. And I was like, all right, Lyle, like, I know we like the Bears, but that doesn't mean you get to jump. Okay. So I felt pretty good about that one.
Did it land? Did you get the laugh?
Yep.
All right.
Yep. I got a laugh and a go Bears. So there you go. Go Bears.
That's a good one, man. I appreciate the interaction. You're already ready. Yeah. Like you've already got the Lyle's dad knowledge down. Well done, sir. We do have more questions. They're not about Lyle. They are about the U.S. men's national team. We got the roster for
you just lost a lot of listeners.
That was it. That was it. Now that that's out of the way, they've moved on.
Yeah.
Is that what allocation disorder is? Like halfway through, do y'all just switch to dog chat and baby chat? I'm sure Paul loves it when you compare owning a dog to having kids.
I don't do that, actually.
That is wise.
I think. Maybe I do. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a real dad, so I don't know.
I don't know, man. You got to feed him. You got to take care of him.
It's probably like 0.5% of what being a real parent is. Like, I have to, you know, there are some commitments involved. It's not that big of a deal, but
I mean,
I have a dog.
There you go. You have a dog. Sam is loudly declaring that for the listeners, and I'm glad we've made that clear. We also have a roster for the upcoming Nations League games and the friendlies. We're going to go through it position by position. We'll see if Sam has any thoughts on it. I'll give my thoughts if I have any. We'll start with the goalkeepers. We've got Ethan Horvath, Chituro Odunze, and David Ochoa. And I should probably mention with those names in mind that I sort of expected this to be the more senior of the rosters, and then the Gold Cup roster to be more experimental. Based on those goalkeeper names alone, Sam, have I got this wrong, or is this just that like Zach Steffen isn't available because of the Champions League, so this is going to be the more senior team?
I think it's sort of with goalkeeper, I think it might be a little funky, because I wouldn't be shocked to see Matt Turner go to the Gold Cup, just because like you only get to play one goalkeeper, right? So it's a little bit different than the other position groups. But yeah, I mean, Steffen would be there if not for the Champions League final, as would Pulisic. We'll get to him later. I would imagine for Nations League, Steffen and Turner will both be there, maybe with Horvath as well on the final group for those two games in Denver. But we'll see.
And we did have a question from Bill DiFilippo. Will David Ochoa booting a ball into the stands cause an international incident, or will he get away with it because of the well-documented commitment to neutrality by the Swiss?
Yeah, no chance he gets away with it. This will be the straw that breaks the camel's back and plunges Switzerland into a full-fledged armed conflict. It will be David Ochoa. and you know, I think we know one thing for certain. Adrian Heath and Michael Boxall will I think be applying for Swiss citizenship and taking up arms against Ochoa.
I love the idea of that being the thing that finally breaks the neutrality. Yeah, like we've dealt with a lot. But
this is it.
Now we gotta call it.
Cross the line that cannot be crossed.
With our defenders, there are 10 of them. Again, a combination of, I'm going to say, established names, less established names, and new names. We've got John Brooks, we've got Reggie Cannon, Justin Shea, Serginho Dest, Mark McKenzie, Matt Miazga, Tim Ream, Brian Reynolds, Anthony Robinson, and DeAndre Yedlin. Whew, I think that's all of them. Sam, for you, Are there names that you are excited to see that could be like the big names, like John Brooks, because of what he's done in the Bundesliga? It could be Justin Che, who has no appearances except for Bayern Munich's reserve team. DeAndre Yedlin coming back in the fold. What do you make of those defenders?
Yeah, I think, you know, we all get excited about the unknown, right? And the unknown in this case is Justin Che, that guy that you just mentioned. He is 17, for those of you who do not know. He is currently on loan with Bayern Munich from FC Dallas. Myself and my athletic colleagues, Paul Tenorio and Jeff Reuter, reported on Wednesday that Bayern and Dallas are talking about a sale. A couple of sources expecting that to get done in the summer, probably for like $3 or $4 million or thereabouts. People I've spoken to are really high on Che. He was an all USL League One selection in 2020 at the age of 16, which is, you know, USL League One is USL League One, but that's no joke, making the best 11 for the league at that age. And he's done really well at Bayern. He's been training with the first team a little bit over there in Germany, and they want to keep him. So that's really positive, and I'm very excited to see him potentially. I'm excited to see his development in general, but I'm excited to see him possibly in this game. So yeah, that's the one that really sticks out for me. I would say similar for Brian Reynolds as well, if he's able to get in. And then Yedlin coming back into the fold. First call up, I believe, since November 2019 for him. He's done well at Galatasaray since he moved to Turkey. So yeah, those are three that kind of stick out for me. And then obviously, you know, some big injuries with Aaron Long being out for a long time with his Achilles, Chris Richards being hurt as well, although that doesn't sound like that major of an issue, but it will keep him out for this game.
So let's take a closer look at some of those then for a second. We had a question from Yaz Nasty on Twitter. It's a lovely username to get us going. Yedlin is back. Nasty. He says, yes, nasty. I should have hit that harder. You're right. Yedlin is back. He seems to not get talked about much in favor of Reggie Cannon. Maybe it's just Yedlin being more of a known quantity versus Reggie Cannon having more upside. But putting their teams side by side, I do think it's a bit closer. Again, this is yes, nasty. Then there's Destin Reynolds, too. Sam, what would be your right back depth chart if you're sort of drawing it up today? And is Sergiño Dest on that depth chart, or do you have him starting at left back instead?
I mean, ideally, it's Sergiño Dest over there, right? But I think for the moment, he's the left back. Man, I think probably Cannon is first. I gotta be honest, I'm not watching a ton of the Portuguese or the Turkish leagues.
No, not for you.
You know, I barely have enough time to watch MLS,
yep,
which is my job. So, you know, like, just there's just like not a ton of other games that are being consumed at this moment, unfortunately. The thing that I really like about Yedlin is his versatility and his ability to go forward, right? So he's the sort of guy where even if he doesn't start at right back,
yep,
you can throw him on if you need a goal. You can throw him on even higher up the field, although with the crop of wingers the U.S. have, you don't really want to do that, but you have the ability to, right? And so I really like that with him. He's a veteran presence. He's a guy that's been around. He played in the World Cup in 2014. So I think it's good from that standpoint. I think Cannon is still number one on that depth chart. But, you know, he's not just competing with the right backs, the other right backs in the crew. If there's a left back that surpasses him and what he's able to offer on the right, then I think that left back will get run at left back and Dest will move on over. So, you know, there's real challenge for that position.
And do you have a preferred starting tandem when it comes to the center backs? Because I would have assumed it would have been John Brooks and Chris Richards. Richards now injured, as you mentioned. So I guess the options could be Matt Miazga, Tim Ream, though he makes more sense as the left center back as opposed to the right one, and then Justin Che, who is playing right center back for Bayern.
And Mark McKenzie.
My bad. Mark McKenzie also in there.
I would assume it'll be Miazga. In terms of my personal preference, again, you kind of want to see more of the unknown, right? We've seen Miazga quite a bit with the national team over the years. I think we have a good idea of what he is and what he is not. I wouldn't hate seeing McKenzie or Che next to Brooks, but I think it'll be Miazga.
I do too. But yeah, I wouldn't mind the experimentation. I don't know if we will end up seeing Justin Che, though, just because it could be one of those players that he brings in and like Berhalter brings in just to see how he does in camp, to get him used to it.
Yeah.
I looked up the German like work permit regulations just to see if there was another sort of like, oh, he needs this cap to get one. I don't think there's anything like that.
No, he has a German passport.
There we go.
So
exactly.
He does not. He does not need that.
So then what it looks like to me with that in mind is that if we don't see Che, that means, yeah, it was sort of that sort of camp to bring him in and get him experience. But if we do, then to me, that's a sign that he is above expectations or performing above the level that was expected, such that now he's getting minutes with the senior national team as a reward for coming in and looking as sharp as he does. So basically, if I see Justin Che starting in this game, should I then assume that he will be starting in the World Cup in 2022?
yes, clearly.
Definitely. No. Cool. Perfect.
No.
Just writing down Sam guarantees World Cup qualification.
So. Like, do you remember some of these friendlies? Like some of the guys, like who was it? Russia 2012? Josh Gatt? You remember that one?
Oh yeah. Oh like, yeah.
A lot can happen.
A lot
right?
can happen.
A lot can happen. I wouldn't make any assumptions. If Che comes in and he does well and he gets playing time, I think you can then take that to mean that he's playing well in this very moment. And then we'll see what the future has in store. I think it's fair to be hopeful for what he might turn into, but can we bank on anything happening 18, 19 months from now? No.
You know, when Sam is the voice of reason, it's both reassuring and alarming at the same time. So on that note, let's talk about the midfield. There are seven of them. Kellen Acosta, Tyler Adams, Julian Green, Sebastian Legette, Weston McKennie, Yunus Musa, and Jackson Yule. Now, there was the news that Tyler Adams will be out for U.S. national team duty due to injury this summer. So our number six in terms of like... Let me try that one again. So our number six options are slightly limited. Are you okay with seeing Kellen Acosta get more minutes then? Because Ryan Enbaum is also curious. He asks, is Kellen Acosta the most natural replacement for Tyler Adams on this roster / in the pool? And also suggests that Sam should plug for new Hoover vacuums. New Hoover vacuums when mom is visiting and your apartment needs a recovery run.
What is that a real thing? Or is that like
know.
A play on New Who?
I believe Hoover. It's a play on New Who. That would be my guess. It's spelled NOU-HOUVE.
I'm not really up to date on like the vacuum industry. I won't lie. More of a sweep and Swiffer kind of guy. So not a ton of vacuuming that goes on. I forget the question. Kellen Acosta.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is he the most natural replacement for Adams in the pool? I mean, in some ways, yes. In other ways, no. Right. I think defensively, in terms of the ground he covers and his experience and ability on that side of the ball, yeah, he probably does a little bit better job of that than Jackson Yule. In terms of what Berhalter is looking for in possession, I think Yule probably provides more of that than Acosta. So it's how do you weigh those two things? What balance can each strike? What kind of form are they in that sort of dictates, okay, who's going to play? I think for now, Yule probably has the edge. But I like Kellen Acosta. I do. I think he's performed well in Colorado. I think he's done a really nice job working himself back into the pool. You know, he was kind of in USMNT Siberia there for a while, lost in the wilderness, and he's gotten himself back on track. And I think that's positive. He wasn't great against Northern Ireland. I thought he was good in the game before that. And he caught a lot of flack for that. But at the same time, I think you got to understand the context. He was in preseason. He hadn't played any matches in like 4 or 5 months. So, you know, that's part of the deal. And he was going up against guys who were in season and in form and playing next to guys who were in season and in form. So, you know, I wouldn't hold that against him too much. So I like Acosta, but I think that's a real battle with Yule. And I think Berhalter has shown so far that Yule is probably ahead of Acosta on that depth chart.
So you and Paul obviously have a lot of like reach, a lot of coverage. You talk to a lot of different players in Major League
we're
Soccer.
We're very important.
Of course, yes. You're very important. We all know this. You're incredibly influential. Don Garber always asking Sam, what do you think? How do you think? What should we do? And with that in mind, like, are there players that you find yourself like having, if not like sympathy is the wrong word, but I guess are there players that you pull for a little bit more for whatever reason from the MLS perspective? Or is it just sort of you're watching the U.S. and whoever stands out? Because I'm not even asking a bias question. It's genuinely just like, I think Kellen Acosta was one who, once he was on the outside of the team, I was like, he didn't show. There were questions of fitness, I think is what it was in the beginning. And now he's back. And I really do find myself pulling for him. And so in that game against Northern Ireland, I remember the coverage being like pretty divided of, oh, he was fine, or no, he was terrible. And there didn't seem right. to be a lot of in between, and there didn't seem to be a lot of positivity.
He
and
wasn't
I can't,
great. He wasn't very good. Yeah. Like, I think he would say that.
And
know?
I think yeah. and I think in the first time I watched it, I thought he was better because I think I was rooting for him. And there was that, I guess there was bias there. That is probably the term for it. And mm-hmm. I just didn't quite realize it. So I guess I'm wondering for you if there are players that you maybe think like, oh, I want that guy to do well. I'm hoping yeah, he kind I mean, of redeems himself or what it might
be. I think
be.
Everyone has that if they're being honest, mm-hmm. you know. And I think particularly for a story like Acosta, kind of like the comeback story, you know. Yeah. Who he was 21 years old and he went and he started a World Cup qualifier and he was really good in that World Cup qualifier at the Azteca, right? And he had these huge things expected for him and he was playing well with Dallas and they won the Supporter Shield. 2017 rolls around. He's going to play well at the Gold Cup and be a key part of that team and then be sold. And he started kind of slumping a little bit for Dallas. He was bad at that Gold Cup. And continued slumping, doesn't get sold, actually gets traded to Colorado and had to find himself again. And it took him a while, but he did that. And I think that's a compelling narrative, right? And I think that's something that is easy to root for. And I think I would be lying a little bit if I said that you don't want to see a redemption story like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That said, I think when I'm watching a game, I would hope I'm able to separate those things. But, you know, we probably all have some blind spots in that area. I think generally speaking, I do like to see MLS guys sort of break the narrative that, oh, these MLS guys, they can't hack it, you know, because I don't buy into that at all on the national team level. So, you know, I do kind of enjoy them seeing them do well. But it's not something that I'm like, you know, I need to like advocate for or push for or anything in my coverage. If it happens, like it's cool, warms my heart a little bit. But I like to think that, you know, I can stay relatively objective and neutral in terms of how I write and report about it.
Is there a player for you that like you don't really get the criticism for or the praise of? Like, is there somebody that you think maybe Twitter, social media gets it wrong? Because I do also have that experience at times where it's like I thought a player was good. I kind of watched the game in a vacuum. Then I'll look on social media. I think that is actually what happened with Kellen Acosta, that then seeing the responses and being like, oh, did I see a different game? Like, I need to go back and watch. I think I have those moments sometimes. I think Michael Bradley was another example of that going back to the unpleasantness of like he seemed to me to be our best midfielder in that time period. Certainly not the case now, but that was one where I think there was also pretty strongly divided opinion. So for you, have you had that experience of sort of thinking a player had a good game or a good tournament or had been good for the sure. team and knowing that it stands in opposition to the common thought?
Yeah, definitely. This happens with me a lot with young players in MLS and with the national team in particular. We've talked about this before, Taylor. but, you know, there's a tendency on soccer Twitter, American soccer Twitter, to like pull these like 10-second clips and be like, player X, you know, he's so good at the progressive passes. Look at this example. Or like, look at this example. Isn't this kid amazing? And it's just like, removed from all context. Like, I think there was, oh man, I think it was the Trinidad and Tobago friendly, and I can't even remember the player. I think it might have been Jesus Ferreira, and I'm not trying to knock Jesus Ferreira, but somebody put a clip out there and it was like, look at how decisive he is when he carries the ball and how he attacks space. And
I feel like it was maybe Joe. I feel like it might have been Joe is what you're
maybe
describing.
Maybe it was
here.
Joe, but like, you know, and to be fair, Ferreira was decisive in all of those things, but there was also no player within like 15 yards of him for this entire clip. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, okay, like we're gassing these guys up and we're not saying, well, look at the context. Trinidad and Tobago is playing like its C team. None of them are in shape and there's no one within spitting distance of the guy. Like, of course he's going to look good. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's important to put those things in context. And I think, you know, sometimes on social media in particular, we struggle to do that. So it's not like any one player in particular necessarily. It's just kind of that whole trend that I often find myself screaming about.
Let's see if you scream about Julian Green, another one that we haven't talked about as much in recent times, but he is back on this roster. Do you think we had a question from our friend Alex on Twitter. Do you think Berhalter just wants to evaluate Green in a camp the way he did for DLT in March? I'm assuming that's DLT. I think that's De La Torre in March. Yeah. Or do you think Green's performance in the Zwei Bundesliga this year has him above Luca De La Torre in the depth chart?
Well, you know, Julian Green was not on the provisional roster for Nations League. De La Torre was, so I'm not sure that he would be above him. I think Berhalter wants to take a look at Green, clearly. Whether or not he will get to or not is an open question at this point. Green's club, who, you know, Greuther Fürth, there's no way that's pronounced even remotely correct.
I mean, it sounded good to me.
They are currently fighting for promotion to the Bundesliga. They're in third place heading into the last game of the season. They have a shot at finishing in the top two, but if they don't finish in the top two, they're going to be in the promotion playoffs, and Green is not going to be available for the Switzerland match. There are a couple other guys, DK and Sargent, are in similar situations in England and Germany, respectively. So he might not even be there, depending on how things go. But yeah, I think it's just kind of a case of Berhalter wanting to take a closer look at a guy who, by all accounts, has had a pretty solid season. So we'll see. We'll see if we see him.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow Grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. We're going to talk about the forwards in a second. First, Sam, I should confirm, Joe says it was definitely him who wrote that tweet.
Sorry, Joe.
Well, Joe pauses to contemplate his new rivalry with Sam. I will tell our listeners that we have seven forwards on the roster: Brendan Aaronson, Daryl DK, Matthew Hoppe, Gio Reyna, Josh Sargent, Jordan Cibachu, Timothy Weah. As always, the attacking group is always very exciting. This group is, I think, especially so just because we do have so many players in such interesting form and exciting form. In my house, interesting tends to mean a negative thing. I mean it positively here because we've got Daryl DK being like the sensation of England, or certainly the championship. Brendan Aaronson looking like he is very much at home with Salzburg, could be at home with another RB club in the future. We've got Matthew Hoppe, I think, being nominated for like Young Player of the Year in the Bundesliga, which is something. Josh Sargent is around. Timothy Weah is exciting. I think it's just it's a group that I can't wait to see
Josh
who gets
Sargent
to play.
Is around.
That was meant to be a dig.
To be fair to Josh Sargent, he's not around much.
This is true.
At Werder Bremen. Anyway.
That was such a soccer nerd burn, and I loved it. And it's really, I don't have any, like, I have no ill will towards Josh Sargent. I think I have a lot of ill will towards Werder Bremen for tuning in and watching them, and they just keep making me think they're going to get it together and be fun, and then they're not. But
I think Greg Berhalter shares that ill will.
I'm sure he does. God. I didn't think about how much bad soccer national team coaches have to watch. That would be less fun. Let's talk about a happier thing then. Who on this of this list are you most excited for, Sam?
Tim Weah.
Yep.
And Brendan Aaronson. Mm-hmm. How about that? I really like Brendan Aaronson, and I think people are sleeping on him a little bit. I know he's in a position, or he plays a position that is, you know, pretty stacked for the U.S. with Reyna and Weah and Pulisic and on, right? But I think he's a really good player. I think he's going to continue his rise. He's done really well at Salzburg, as you mentioned. I'm curious to see how long he stays there. I would guess at least another season. But I would think if he continues to progress that there will be a relatively significant move in line for him, whether that's to Leipzig or whether that's somewhere else, in the not too distant future. Also a big fan of his hair, looking for some tips from Brendan. You know, he's got probably stronger follicles than I do, but I'm rocking a poor man's Aaronson right now. So if you're listening, Brendan, just hit me up. Okay, we can talk.
Have you have you talked to him in person or over the phone, or have you spoken to him much?
No, maybe like on a Zoom press conference, but no, never in person.
I was curious how Philly he is, but I a quick Google search tells me that he's from Medford, New Jersey. So maybe the question is how New Jersey
Philly,
is he?
Philly suburb, I believe.
Okay. Medford, all right. New
Jersey. You know, it's on the Jersey side. I don't know. Can't answer that. But I'm supposed to talk to Jim Curtin soon, so I'll ask him.
All right, please do, but don't. Yeah. Ask him more relevant questions to him.
I'm going to ask.
I see him play for Salzburg, and one of the things that stands out for me is when you have a new player and a young player at that coming into a new club, There tends to be like some hesitation, a little bit of slowness either to play the style, to know what's going on. We saw it with Christian Pulisic at Chelsea, where some of like, especially early, he was like slow to pass. He wasn't trying to take people on, and that has obviously improved. But for Aaronson, I saw him not short of confidence taking people on, but also not hesitating to get into scraps and get physical. And he does seem like a player who, like my dad, when he complains about the national team, it's always, there's a lack of effort. It's not the team that used to work so hard in the past. And I feel like Brendan Aaronson is the type of player that he will very much enjoy.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever been afraid to do that. He certainly had a good work rate in Philly. And as he kind of grows physically more, as he gets a little bit older, and I don't think he's quite done doing that. I think that would only improve in terms of like his willingness to go in. I think it really helped him having an American coach, you know, Jesse Marsh. So it eases the cultural transition, makes it easier for him off of the field, and it can give him a little bit more confidence and a little bit more build up. And then the other thing is like Philly play a kind of Red Bull style, right? They don't love being on the ball. They're decent when they're on it, but they're kind of an off the ball, press you, turn you over, hit you in transition kind of team. So he was very familiar with the setup. Ernst Tanner came from Salzburg, to Philadelphia, the sporting director for the Union. So there are a lot of kind of cross club connections there. Jim Curtin, who I just mentioned, and Jesse Marsh are very good friends. So, you know, all of those things, I think, probably helped him hit the ground running. But I remember I spoke to Jesse Marsh about this probably in February, not too long after Aaronson moved over there, and he was already doing pretty well. And he was just really impressed by how Aaronson was adapting, and he was learning German really quickly, and he was getting in with his teammates, and he was working really hard and staying after and just basically throwing himself into things, like 150%. And so I think that's positive, and I think it bodes well for his future too.
And one quick question from Sean Hardgrove for you. From this group, who, if any, do you expect or hope to see on the Gold Cup roster? Let's go with who would you like to see on the Gold Cup roster, which means we get to see them a few more times for a few more minutes.
Interesting. I don't know that we'll see any of these guys on the Gold Cup roster. Certainly not Reyna, Weah. I would be surprised if we saw Aaronson, who will obviously have a new coach in Salzburg. I suppose DK could be there, but again, that would be surprising. I think the idea is that these guys in Europe have been playing pretty much nonstop, with the exception of the COVID break, for a long, long, long time. They could use some time off to recharge their physical batteries, to recharge their mental batteries, and really get things kind of rested and ready ahead of the really important matches, which are the World Cup qualifiers starting in the fall.
Yeah, and even somebody like Jordan Sibachu, who maybe wants, like Berhalter would want, a little bit more time with him. I think that move to Young Boys has been made permanent. So then there's the argument of give him some rest, let him get a full preseason, let him then have the form, and then you can play him later on down the road. So I think you're probably right that the answer is going to be none of these players do we think we'll see. In terms of who I wouldn't mind seeing, maybe it's Sibachu, just to see what he can bring in, or maybe it's Daryl DK to see if he is like the number nine going into a competition, how he handles that responsibility and that sort of positional responsibility and requirements playing for the national team. So that would be fine with me, but I'm also fine not to see anybody if it means they're resting.
100%. And if DK moves, if Orlando does sell him, I would say there's zero chance he goes to the Gold
Cup. That is a very good shout. Well done, sir. We've talked about the roster. Obviously, we will continue to talk about the U.S. roster on the Total Soccer Show. But Sam, I don't want to I want to make sure that we get to talk a lot of MLS, because I have a lot of questions for you. I want to talk crew rebrand at some point, but I want to start with the salary dump. Is that one of your like five favorite days of the MLS year?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. Like, people like to pigeonhole me, you know, and is that sort of like weirdo nerd who loves the... yeah, it is. What can I say? It's cool to dive into. what am I talking about? It's cool to dive into. It's interesting to see, especially this year, because we didn't get the numbers last year. So there was a little bit more buildup this time around, which, as we all know, makes the payoff that much more exciting.
And which ones were the most exciting for you? Like, which ones stood out as being surprising deals in a good way? And then which ones stood out as being the opposite of that?
Opposite, I'll start.
Yeah, I had a feeling you might.
Frank O'Hara stood out in a bad way. He's making almost $3 million for FC Dallas, 10th highest paid player in the league, I believe, according to these numbers. Although that, I don't think Jefferson Soteldo was on the list. So, you know, maybe he's the 11th. The production that he's provided for FC Dallas in no way even comes close to justifying that number. Like, you know, if I'm FC Dallas, I'm like asking real questions about, okay, when do I just start Ricardo Pepi every game? Because Hara isn't doing it. So that's one that stuck out in a bad way. Jürgen Damm, the same. He's on $1.5 million in Atlanta, which is a lot of money for what he provides. So those are two that kind of weren't great. You know, in terms of the ones that are good value, A lot of the homegrowns, right? Which is sort of a cheat and an unfair answer from my part. But a lot of those homegrowns, you know, they're on their first contracts. Some of them are really producing in a major way. They don't even count on the budget. So that's impressive. But yeah, so a lot of those guys. And then in terms of the non-homegrowns, Mark Anthony Kay, I think, makes around $250,000. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's in that neighborhood. And he's one of the more important players on one of the more important and influential teams in the league. He's done really well for LAFC, and he's an absolute bargain. So I think that's one where they're getting extreme value out of that player, and not even a homegrown player. So that's one that sticks out. And then, of course, my man, Nuhu, you know? I'm not even kidding, Taylor. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, I think he's on 150 or thereabouts. And, like, if I was voting today for MLS Defender of the Year, and it's admittedly very, very early, I think I would be voting for Nuhu. He's been awesome this year in that new left center back role for Seattle. And, yeah, I think the Sounders are getting great value out of him for sure.
So when we talk about salaries and that type of thing, it tends to be who is like making too much money for what they're doing, who is not making enough money, tends to be the way it goes. I hope this question makes sense. It does to me. We'll see if it does when I say it out loud. Who do you think is the most fairly or justly compensated player in the league? So that somebody who's on 100,000, but that seems to be like where they're at. It could be Carlos Vela because of everything he brings to the table. Like, who's the player who you think most justifies what they're earning?
The most fairly compensated, that's interesting. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking in those terms. Darlington Nagbe, I think, he might deserve more. He's like a 1.6, so that might be a good one. Lucas Zelarayán, he's like around 2, maybe somewhere in that area. Santiago Sosa, 500,000 for an intriguing young player with a big transfer fee. I kind of like that.
Oh, I like that one.
I think those are three that sort of stick out. I do want to mention a couple other, like, real quick. Seattle was 12th on this list, and they're kind of running the league right now, and it's kind of amazing. Rui Diaz and Ladero are not super duper highly paid DPs. They both make around $2 million, and they're two. Ladero's been hurt like all year so far, but when they're healthy, they're two of the best players at their positions in the league.
How much was Frank O'Hara making?
2.9. He makes all more than both of them. Yeah. So, and so does Victor Wanyama, and so does Jozy Altidore, and so does, I think Albert Ruznok. So Robert Berich, Jurgen Locadia. Oh my God. That might be the worst contract in the league. But anyway, those guys are really good, and they're decent value too. So just worth shouting out.
All right, I like it. I also liked the comparison to other leagues that you all did when you were kind of breaking down the salary dump. For listeners who haven't read that piece, how does MLS stack up to Liga MX? How well does it stack up to other leagues in Europe?
Sure. So the average salary in MLS, or average team spend on salary in MLS, is around $12.5 million. That's, Liga MX is hard to know because there aren't like really reliable figures. But when you talk to people, and this has been reported, I think, by ESPN, they generally say that the salaries, the average salary is about 20 to 30% higher. You know, for a team, for big teams like Tigres or Monterrey or America, for instance, they might be spending 50, 60 million on salaries for their entire team. Right. So there's a big difference there. The top end in MLS is about 20 million. And that's Miami and Toronto, pretty much. The LA clubs aren't too far behind either. And then, championship, the top end, when they're accounting for promotion bonuses, right, that can get as high as $75 million. And the average is probably 40, 50, somewhere in there. So to give a little bit of perspective, I'm trying to remember the other leagues that we tallied up. Serie A, the average, I think, was 65. Premier League, the average was like 70, 80, thereabouts, 80 million roughly per team, just on salaries alone. And then, of course, the highest spending teams in those leagues are like above 200 on salaries. So that's the perspective. The weird thing about MLS is that a lot, like obviously the spend isn't evenly allocated across the roster. So when you look at some of these teams, they're spending 70% of their total outlay on their five highest paid players. And that's how the rules are sort of set up in MLS. But it's interesting, and it's a real dynamic that should be thought of and accounted for when you talk about spending in the league.
Is there a team that bucks that trend a little bit? Is there one that is more sort of like equal across?
Yeah, there are a few, and I'm not sure that it's the right strategy, right? Because when you look at the teams that are most top heavy, read them off. I think Inter Miami was the most, which isn't a great example. But Toronto FC, LA Galaxy, LAFC, Seattle, New England, You know, these are teams that have been successful, right? In some cases, you have some of the most successful teams in the league. Oddly enough, this sort of surprised me when I looked at it. Atlanta doesn't allocate as much to the top five as some of these other teams. They're under 50%, which only a handful of teams were. I think the Red Bulls spent the least on their top five relative to the rest of their spend, and they were under 40% on their top five, which was by far the least of any team in the league. So they're, I guess, the most equitable. Their curve is the flattest of everybody. So yeah, take that for whatever it's worth.
And now we come to the Ohio portion of the show. Where is FC Cincinnati in their sort of roster spend? What do you make of what they've spent and how they built?
They are fifth overall in roster spend.
That blew my mind.
Salary. That does not include transfer fees, of course, which FC Cincinnati has not been shy about spending either.
Uh-uh.
Right? So if you wanted to include transfer fees, they might even be higher on that list. They are pretty top heavy. They're around 60% on the top five. But my goodness. And I think you're going to ask me about the story I wrote where I spoke with their president, Jeff Birding. I mean, it's just so ill-fitting. The pieces don't work together. And we can go into that more, but that's the main thing. It's not efficient because the pieces don't work together. And the pieces don't work together because I don't think there's much strategy at that club.
So when you're talking about the pieces, you're talking about the roster, correct? Or are you talking about the front office as well and everything else going on?
I suppose you could expand it to whatever you wanted to. But yes, I was referring to the roster.
Gotcha. And with that roster, like, do you think, is there an argument to be made that they are sort of spending to get things fixed? Or do you think it's a sign that they're still spending without a plan?
I mean, they're trying to get things fixed, right? They would tell you the plan is to get things fixed. But if you look at just kind of where they've put their money, it's like, all right, last year you signed Jurgen Locadia and Yuya Kubo as DPs. Right, two guys that play striker can play on the wing. This year, what do? You sign Brenner, a number 9, as a DP, and you sign Lucho Acosta, a number 10, as a DP. And so Brenner kind of is redundant with Locadia and with Kubo. And Kubo's now playing as an 8, which is not something he's ever done before, right? And isn't something that he really knows how to do because he's never done it before. And Cincinnati has suffered for it because, you know, defensively, they haven't been good in the midfield or anywhere else for that matter. So they have a lot. They have a decent amount of talented attacking players in particular, right? It's not to say that these guys are bad at soccer or anything like that, but they just don't really work well. And they haven't really put any time or effort into improving the defense, which has been awful during their time in MLS. They signed Jeff Cameron, who should help, but I think he's almost 36 now, and you know, I'm guessing he wasn't signed for cheap. They have 6 guys, I believe, making $1 million or more, which is most of any team in the league. And it's just sort of like there isn't any, I don't know if it's patience or they just panic and try and spend their way out of problems without thinking, okay, what do we actually need, right? And understanding that filling the holes that they have is going to take some time, and being patient enough to actually have and disciplined enough to actually take the time to fill those holes, as opposed to what they've done, which is kind of like, okay, like, here's a shiny object, let's go get it.
And in that article, it seemed to me like there was a consistent lack of humility is how I would phrase that. That a lot of decisions seem to be, we know what we're doing, we've got this, trust us. And then there's the moments like, and then we reached out to the league about like finding a person who could advise us on this. And there seems to be a lot of decisions made from a, we've run a club in USL, we know what we're doing, we'll figure it out as we go perspective. And that does seem to be a common thing in my mind with teams that are just starting out, is the ones who think, we know what we're doing, we've run a business, we've run another franchise in another league, we got this. They tend to be the ones that I think struggle more than others.
I would agree with that. And you can say it's arrogance, you can say it's a lack of humility, you can use other nicer words. At the end of the day, it's pretty much the same thing. FC Cincinnati thought they knew what they were doing. They thought they had a handle on things, and they didn't, right? And to be fair to them, they were dealt a tough hand. They had 270 days or so from when they were announced as an expansion team and their first game in MLS, right? That's not a lot of time.
No.
It's nine months. You know, some of these teams have 2, 3, 4 years to prepare, right? And so obviously their outcomes can be a little bit more, they can be better planned. Cincinnati's doing it on the fly while competing in USL. They put a lot of energy in their final season in 2018 in USL into USL, and they didn't focus as much as they should have on MLS. And this is something that I think Jeff Birding told me, right? And if he could go back and do it again, he would change that, right? But they also approached it as, hey, we've done a lot of good things in USL on the field. We've done a lot of good things in USL off the field. I would say they've continued to do good things off the field in MLS. Their stadium looks fantastic. They have a good fan base, right? Like, that's hitting still. But on the field, they didn't know what they were getting into. They brought up, I think, 10 USL players, 8 sort of, and then Fatai Alasha and Fernando Adi, who were with them in USL but were acquired for MLS halfway through that 2018 season. And they were counting on a number of those guys to like be big time players for them. And it was just like a really naive approach. They didn't have a GM. Jeff Birding was the GM. He has no technical experience in soccer at all. Alan Koch was the head coach. He was in charge of a lot of recruitment. And then Luke Sassano, who former MLS player, came over from the Cosmos. He worked there in their front office while Gio Savarese was in charge. He was the technical director and kind of assisting and helping out. And they just dug themselves into a hole, right? They burned through a ton of allocation money, and expansion teams get extra allocation money. And that's a real asset, right? When you look at like Atlanta and trading for Darlington Nagbe, how did they do that? It's because they had the extra allocation money from being an expansion team, right? When you look at LAFC and some of the moves that they've been able to make over the years, same thing, right? Cincinnati burned through all of that on really questionable players, like early. And they didn't, so they hired Gerard Nykamp from the Netherlands, a guy who doesn't know the league or the rules. He has a learning curve for all of that. And he doesn't have the advantage of having the extra allocation money because it's all gone, you know? And so, you know, the way I like to think of it broadly is Cincinnati was dealt a tough hand, right? They were in a hole, not of their own making, from the very beginning with the timeline. And in their efforts to try and get out of that hole, they've consistently dug themselves deeper into it. And it's, you know, I don't see them getting out of it this year. That's for damn sure.
So you may have just answered my question with that one, but the message that Jeff Birding seemed to be trying to convey was that, like, we've made mistakes. We understand that. We know we didn't get it right, but we're fixing it. We're changing it. And this time, trust us, it's going to be better. That was my, at least, distillation of what he was saying. And that makes me wonder if you think things will be different going forward, if not this season, then maybe next season or the one after. Or do you think we are likely to get another, okay, this time we're resetting, but this time we know for sure we've got it right?
I mean, I don't have faith that they know what they're doing right now. I think they'll be better. They should be better. They're more talented, right? But they've given up, I think, 14 goals in 4 games, I want to say. Mm-hmm. It's not great.
No, it's not.
to say the least, right? They've scored. They have a better attack this year, for sure. Like, Lucho Costa, he looked lively on Sunday against Miami, and he did some good things, right? So, like, there's some real quality on the field for them. I do question how long that locker room is going to hold together. You have a lot of big personalities, and if you continue losing games in the way that they've lost them, there's going to be some bad vibes, and it's going to be a hell of a job for Yopstam to keep that group motivated and focused and united. And if he isn't able to do that, then these things can fall apart really fast, right? And get worse really fast. And Cincinnati was, Birding was open about not having a great locker room that first season when they really struggled in 2019 and how that played a role. And, you know, like, that could happen again. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like sometimes I run the risk of making too much of MLS as this unique beast, because you can come in, and if you give it the proper respect and you pay attention to the history and you try and learn, you can do a good job. But if you come in with zero experience, there's a learning curve, and it's taking time. And Nykamp hasn't been the quickest learner, I think it's fair to say. And so you have him. He hired Ron Jans. Ron Jans left in scandalous circumstances. Jaap Stam comes in. Nobody with any MLS experience. And that's how they entered the league. Nobody really with any MLS experience besides Sassano as a player and Koch briefly as an assistant. And it's just, there's no know-how there. And MLS is a different league than any other league in the world. Like, you have to understand it if you want to operate efficiently. And they haven't shown that they understand it. So they do, I'm not going to really believe it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's fair. I want to ask you a question about Cincinnati, about two different teams. But first, I want to ask you, it's a multi-part question. Who is, you think, the best example of a well-run expansion team? That first season, hitting the ground running, making smart decisions. I'm assuming it's Atlanta, but I wanted to ask before I moved on.
Yeah, Atlanta was awesome, okay. Man. They hit on everything, right? LAFC was really, really good, too. No doubt about it. I think, but like on the, you know, those teams had huge budgets, right? Mm-hmm. And so that really makes it easier, right? Let's call it what it is. Makes it easier. I think Nashville did a really good job, and I criticized them for some of the things during their build, but I think Mike Jacobs and Gary Smith did a really nice job of saying, hey, we know what our budget is. We know that we're not going to be able to go out there and play pretty soccer and have success. Like, we just don't have the money to do that, particularly on the timeline, the expansion timeline that we're on. So we're going to build a team heavy on MLS experience with guys that know the league, that understand the league, Dax McCarty, Anibal Godoy, Walker Zimmerman, and we're going to be really committed and really united. We're going to defend as a group. We're going to defend hard. We're going to defend well, and we're going to look to hit teams on the break, and that's going to be our foundation, and we're going to try and build from there. Right? And we're going to try and add on to that from there. And so I'm curious to see what they're able to add on to it this year. But I think that's a really good example of a team that did it without a huge budget. And, you know, they didn't go on and win, right? They weren't MLS Cup champions or anything like that. But they made the playoffs and they made it all the way to conference semifinal. So they had a really good year. And I think Austin has some of those similar principles too, although they've spent a little bit more money than Nashville did in year one.
So if we have those kind of like three tiers of sorts of like the Atlanta LAFC spending the money for success, Nashville, Austin to some extent like spending less money but still having success, and then maybe on the other side would be somebody like Cincinnati, where do you see St. Louis and Charlotte trending?
Oh, it's so hard to say. You know, neither of them even have a coach yet, right? Charlotte signed a few players. They were meant to come into the league this year, I believe. Mm-hmm. They're coming in next season. You know, both hired GMs without experience in MLS. So in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, but in my opinion, that's a slight mark against them. Charlotte has assembled, you know, they've built out their technical staff with people that are experienced in the league. So that helps for sure. But I mean, I don't know. To answer your question, like if I had to guess, I would say I expect more from Charlotte than I do from St. Louis. But who knows, man? A lot could change. I don't think either is going to set the world on fire early on.
And how many new logos do you think the Crew will have had by the time we get Charlotte and St. Louis playing?
I mean, well, they're averaging, three per week right now. So I think that puts us at around like 110, 120.
Yeah, that feels about right. I really enjoyed your article about the Crew rebrand, especially that you made it, I think, 13 paragraphs before noting that it was all very unnecessary. That did seem like a thing that you were wrestling with yourself to not say immediately, but you did get there.
I should have.
Yeah, it did really feel like that was fighting to get out the whole time. What were your sort of takeaways from this Crew rebrand saga?
It was very unnecessary. Like, it's so stupid, man. Like, that's my takeaway. It's like, how dumb is this? Like, how dumb and unnecessary and forced and just like shooting yourself in the foot to the millionth degree. Like, it's just like, what are you doing? What? Like, why are you doing this? No one wanted this.
No.
Who wanted this? And what do you think you're achieving? Like, that's the thing. It's like, even if you knock this rebrand out of the park, what are you achieving? Are you turning Columbus into a global soccer city? No, you're not doing that. Not with a new logo or a new name. Are you kidding? That's not going to do anything for you globally. You're still Columbus. No one even knows. No one in Europe knows where Columbus is, right? I like Columbus. It's a nice town. I'm not trying to crap on Columbus. But like this whole idea, we need to be a global brand. Mm. Shut up. Sell out your own stadium. Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
So that's one. And just like, why? The logo was good. People love the crew name. Like, why? What are you achieving? You're opening a new stadium, right? That's the pop, right? That's the thing that's going to pull in locals that haven't really paid attention to you before, right? And you're doing it on the back of a championship. Like, you don't need a rebrand to sell this thing. Everything's there already. Just activate on it. And instead, you do this ridiculous process where you consult your fans and you do your focus groups, but you don't actually listen to what they say.
Nope.
And then you come up with something that is predictably and universally hated, right?
Yep.
And then you have to go through the exercise of canceling it and saying, whoops, and redoing it a week later. And I guess to be kind and to be fair, credit to them for acknowledging they messed up and fixing it. But why did you mess up in the first place? This is so dumb, man. It's just like there are too many people, I guess, with not enough to do in MLS or at the ownership level. And so they're just like, oh, like, let's rebrand. Like, that's something that we can do. Like, that's a way to occupy our time. Like, no, just focus on facilitating a better atmosphere in your own stadium. Focus on engaging with your fans. Focus on putting a good product on the field. That's how you market this stuff. It's hard to pull off, but the concept isn't tough to understand, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to actually achieve and execute, but like, just be conscientious and work hard at all of those things and try and be good at your job. And you don't need to rebrand to pull new people in. And like, no one even cares, man. Like, no one roots for a soccer team because of their logo. Like, come on.
Honestly, I don't mean this in jest. Do you think there's a chance that owners do think that's part of it? That like, if we have an attractive new logo, people in England and the Netherlands will...
Yes, they like, say that. They say it in the press releases.
Oh boy.
This is part of us becoming a global brand. Columbus said that in their release. Chicago said it in theirs. Montreal said it. I don't know if Houston did, but they probably did. They all do.
But they really think that the crest itself is what, like, do they just want people wearing that in Europe and Africa and Asia?
It's the crest itself necessarily. It's the whole vibe, right? It's the crest. It's the name. It's the feeling, right? And like, it's something new and trendy and cool. Just like, man, no one's going to root for MLS because they think the graphic design is cool.
Nah.
Like, if a person decides, hey, I'm going to follow MLS, what team am I going to pick? Then maybe they pick based on something like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think there are a million examples of Americans doing that with European teams, right? So fair enough there. But they need to cross the bridge of, hey, I'm going to follow MLS first, right? And the reason people follow the Premier League, right, the reason they cross that bridge in England is, oh, like, this is a good product on the field. It's fun and exciting to watch. And in the stands, the atmospheres are fantastic, and that elevates my viewing experience. Like I said, it's not rocket science what people are interested in and what makes them interested in different sports leagues, right? It's hard to pull that off, and it's hard to grow that, and it's hard to build that. But like, that's what you need. Like, that's what you need. You don't need this weird new logo. And like, it sucks, man, because like, the Crew is a cool name, in my opinion. And I think it sort of straddles this line between American sports and like, global football really well, right? Where it's not a name that you would see in the NFL or the NBA or college sports, right? But it's not really a name that you would see. It's not a name you would see in Europe either, but it's sort of like right in between. And I would say the same for the Revolution, for the Fire, for the Union, for a few of these other teams, right? And that's the space that MLS exists in, right? It's sort of this in-between area. And so I thought it really like captured that nicely, and it had this history behind it because the fans gave it meaning for 25 years. And then new owners come in and they're like, nah, we don't need that. And I still haven't heard a good reason articulated as to why they thought they needed to do this.
Well, and this is where I end up with it. And I'm not a Crew fan, so like my opinion, I will say, doesn't matter or doesn't really matter. But like, I have seen some people saying like, good on them. They walked it back. They listened to the fans, and that's what an owner needs to be, a person who will listen and adjust. And I feel like if they were truly doing that, they would have done that from the outset and realized that this wasn't going to be popular.
I mean, it's better than doubling down and sticking with their guns on it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what Montreal has done. Their fans don't like the rebrand, right?
That's true.
And like, they're saying, no, like, too bad. This is it. Deal with it. right? So it could be worse, right? It's not the worst case scenario, but it's also not good. And it's, I don't know, it's embarrassing, right? Like, let's call it what it is. It's embarrassing for the crew. It's embarrassing, I think, a little bit for MLS. And this, like, dude, like, this is the second time in 2 years that this has happened in MLS. Like, that's kind of ridiculous, right? Like, you don't, like, I don't, maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like you don't really see rebrands get walked back very often in, like, business or sports.
No.
You know?
I think Leeds, like, is the only other one I can think of outside of Major League Soccer.
And it's just like, I don't know, like, what's going on? Like, can't we do a little better?
I still think that we're currently in the age of out of touch billionaire white dude, like, surrounded by yes men, thinks, like, people are gonna love this, it's gonna be great. And then he
has a billionaire white woman, you know.
Good call.
She's the one that runs the crew, she's in charge. So,
all right, you know, make that a category.
I agree, out of touch. And listen, like, if they had come out and said from the very beginning, the onset of this process, hey, we're exploring a rebrand because, you know, we're gonna keep the crew name because you love it and it predates Precourt. But Precourt did this logo, and we want to shed all ties with Anthony Precourt. Mm-hmm. And we want to include you on the design process and make it collaborative. Like, I think crew fans would have embraced that. You know what I mean? And instead, they did it their own way.
And I think that's where I just still stay confused as to, like, is it like we want the surprise factor? We want the unveiling? I just don't get why. That seems like a slam dunk, is incorporate the fan base. Maybe you end up getting disparate positions, and that's the threat.
I think in design, you need one voice at the end of the day. And I think the Fire, I would guess, are running into this sort of issue where you're getting a million different cooks in the kitchen, and that can be counterproductive, right? So I get why you kind of don't open it up all the way. But, I mean, at the same time, it's just like, open it up for ideas. You know, you're not going to please everybody, right? Understand that. But you can incorporate different elements from different places that people suggest, and you can make it feel more collaborative than they did, right? And that would have saved everyone a whole lot of trouble. But, you know, to quote Darren Revelle, which is not something that anyone should really ever do, you know, or to paraphrase him, he could be like, I'm worried for our club, but this is tremendous content. So you can't really knock it from that side of it, right?
No, I mean, I don't think you can. I think we're talking about it. There was that conspiracy theory. Do you buy into that?
That's it, right? It's just like they're just faking us out.
Final thing I wanted to ask you about, I appreciate how generous you've been with your time, was about the Houston Dynamo. We don't often end up talking about them when you're on the show, but that's all about to change because we're going to talk about them very briefly right now. Sounds like they're about to get a new owner, as are the Houston Dash. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so the team has been up for sale for a while now, and it emerged on Wednesday that majority owner Gabriel Brenner is close to an agreement to sell the team to Ted Siegel. So there's not a ton out there about Ted Siegel. He is based in New York/New Jersey. He owns a company that is called EJS Group, and it's a real estate development and finance company. His father, I believe, owns, I can't remember the name of it. It's a family business. Siegel used to work for it, and they do a lot of stuff in the power and energy space, and I believe that's where the money is from in this deal. Ted Siegel is a young guy, I think early 40s from what I've been able to gather. So, you know, it sounds like it's going to be a $400 million or so purchase price. And that's, you know, that does not include the land that the stadium or the training facility sit on, because those are owned by the county through the stadium authority. So, you know, that's a lot of money for Houston. But the sense is that this team is a sleeping giant. You know, it's a big, big market, and the demographics are good in terms of age, in terms of diversity, in terms of people that like soccer in that area. And the Dynamo have failed to tap into that completely. And it's bizarre because they have this stadium that's right downtown. And Houston isn't like a super centralized place. But they drew better when they were playing, sharing the college football stadium with the University of Houston in a less centralized location. And why? Because the team was good. And it's not now. It's like, again, another club that's done a rebrand, and it's like, who cares? Put a good team on the field and people will go. Like, do that. You know what I mean? So we'll see. I mean, we'll see if Ted Siegel and his group are able to do that. I think it's fair to say if they're spending $400 million on the team that they are going to be more willing to spend than Brenner and his group were. And for those of you wondering, yes, James Harden will retain his minority stake in the club. So
I know that was high on the list.
So there's a lot. I mean, the Brooklyn Nets, that's the MLS team of the NBA. Steve Nash, part owner of the Whitecaps. Kevin Durant, part owner of the Philly Union. Harden, as mentioned, with the Dynamo. So you got a lot of ties there. It's kind of weird.
We do. I think like the tie that I most appreciate is you tying in the idea of the rebrand is supposed to be when you're good, or like you're like, be good and then people will be really interested.
Who cares? Just be good. Like, oh my God.
I said this to Paul. It's just like, to me, the idea of rebranding is to say like, okay, things have not been good. This is our fresh start. And from here, we're going to be good. We're going to make smart choices. And it's like, you're literally, or I guess not literally, but you are visually hitting a reset button that should then correspond to what your team is actually doing. And I don't really get the idea of let's just change up the logo and that's what people will care about. So I'm hoping that we see less of that and more on-field production and then rebranding if the situation requires.
It's easier to change a logo than it is to fix a roster, right? Yeah. So if you have people in a club that are like, hey, we're flagging, we need something, we need a jolt, right? Let's do a rebrand.
Yay.
Like, it's easier to fix that than to get results on the field. So I don't know. It's dumb, man. It's dumb.
On that note, that feels like a great note to end on. What are you guys talking about on allocation disorder this week?
We are going to talk a lot about salary stuff. Yay. We'll probably talk about some of the crew stuff, the walk back. I don't think we'll spend a ton of time on that because it's been pretty well covered. Probably talk some USMNT. I don't know, man. We don't prepare for that show. You kidding?
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing your completely improvised, no rules, no plans at all show. But for now, Sam, thank you very much for taking the time to talk U.S. roster and Major League Soccer with me.
Thank you, Taylor.
Listeners, thank you all very much for listening, and we will talk to you all again very soon.